For members only, Golf Smarter number 316, published on January 17, 2012.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Why We Golf with author Paul Staley and a bonus from Martin Chuck.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to Golf Smarter for members only, Paul.
Well, Fred.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing fine. I have a very simple question for you, and that is, why do we golf?
Well, the simple answer is, I don't think we know any better. what we're doing out there is basically hanging out with our friends, going out into this wonderful expanse of trees and meadows, launching objects into the air, going and retrieving them, sort of celebrating those rare occurrences when it all works out for us. And when you think about it, all we're doing really is we're reenacting the hunter-gatherer experience. It's kind of in our genes. We're actually doing what we did, you know, millions of years ago, and we just go out and do it on weekends and keep score.
You know, at first your answer was like, yeah, but why do we golf? I mean, why do we go back, right?
You know? Well, we're gluttons for punishment,
yeah.
And we keep thinking we can do it better. So, you know, we keep trying. I mean, it's, you know, it's that whole quest thing that, you know, drives us to try to do this better. And, you know, we get drawn back by, you know, the shots that work out. And, you know, maybe we can get a couple more of those next time around.
I like the idea of the hunter-gatherer. How did you get to that?
How did I get to that? I think actually by going out and behaving a little bit like a caveman myself. You know, if you think about it, you start acting in a really sort of, you know, primordial way. You know, you start talking to objects and you think they can listen to you. You know, you think trees have certain sort of magnetic attraction for your ball. I mean, I think it throws you back into this much more primitive mindset. And it just occurred to me one day, well, wait a minute. You know, maybe this is what's going on. Maybe this is why I can't stop myself from playing something that actually makes me miserable some of the time.
And how did you get there? I mean, what? Where did you? Okay, so obviously, I haven't been clear with anybody but you. You know what I'm talking about. But you've come out with a book. Is it self-published? I'm assuming.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
And the book is called Why We Golf. And I'm assuming you're not a PGA professional, correct?
That would be correct, Fred.
So you're just like one of us. You're just a guy who loves to play weekend golf and would love to play more than just weekends.
Exactly.
Have you been playing your whole life?
Well, that's kind of interesting. My mom introduced me to the game when I was around 12.
Okay.
And just as a side note, at that point in my life, I melded two sports together, much to my detriment. So I was still playing Little League baseball. And I started golf. And I started hitting some of the highest fly balls in the history of Palo Alto Little League. I'll never forget, there was a dad sitting in the back of me in one game, and I swung, and the guy goes, four! So then I started playing tennis, and I kind of dropped golf. And then I picked golf back up maybe 15, 20 years ago. But I have this habit of sort of moving my feet around and kind of getting up on my toes like you want to do when you're hitting a good forehand. So I left the game, came back to it, a little bit to my wife's chagrin, because when we met many, many, many years ago, I was this ponytailed kind of hippie kid from Northern California. And then I exposed myself to her like 20 years later as a golfer. And she's like, well, you didn't tell me you were a golfer. But, yeah, he was always in there inside me.
That's very interesting. Palo Alto Little League. Did you come across Steve Jobs growing up? I mean, isn't that in the same area at the same time?
No, it is the same area. Now, we know for better or for worse, our paths did not cross.
Okay. Just a side note here. What brought you to the point of taking your frustrations of the golf course when you, I guess, got back into it as you got older, and said, I need to write a book about this?
Well, I've always liked writing. And I started sort of having these little sort of riffs that would occur to me, and I'd jot them down. And I'm a member at Lake Merced Golf Club in Daly City.
And just south of San Francisco.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, part of that complex of great courses down in that corner of the world.
And that's right near where the Olympic Club is, correct?
Correct. We can see the Olympic Club from a couple of our holes on the course.
Right. So you've got the Olympic Club, Harding Park, and Lake Merced.
And San Francisco.
And San Francisco. All these great golf courses, and just you can't get into Olympic Club. That's why you go to Lake Merced. What's the deal there? Or you just can't afford Olympic Club, so you go to Lake Merced?
Well, you know, the story there is that, you know, I'd started playing golf again, and at the time I was playing my rounds at Glen Eagles. It was a great little nine-hole layout in McLaren Park in San Francisco, where a couple of holes run across the Sunnydale housing projects. It's an interesting environment in which to play. But our oldest son was playing for the junior Maccabee team and practicing at Lake Merced. And I'll never forget, there was one day I had to go out and pick him up, and I started walking out on this pristine fairway at Lake Merced, and I think to myself, wait a minute, I'm the guy that has to worry about getting robbed or shot on the third or fourth holes of Glen Eagles, and my son's out here? No. This is we got to do something about this. And you know, I had a little money in the bank, and I went to Merced and applied, and you know, been a member there now for about 14 years.
Well, okay, so I interrupted you. You were starting to tell the story of playing at Lake Merced.
Oh yeah. So then I said, look, I'll start writing these things down and put them in as columns in the newsletter. So I started publishing what I call It's All in Your Head as monthly columns in our club newsletter, and people just love them. And, you know, it started out as a series of articles about the mental and psychological challenges of the game. And the response was so positive, I said, well, you know what, let me see if I can't expand this into a book. So I made it this 18-chapter book that looks at golf from a variety of angles. And it has been, you know, a real labor of love. It's taken me more than a few years, but now it's done, and I'm hoping to get it in as many people's hands as possible.
Sure. And it seems kind of some parallels here together. You know, you write a column called It's All in Your Head, and I do the podcast called Golf Smarter. I think we're trying to, you know, do the same thing, is talk about the mental side of the game and how to improve your game by just understanding, you know, getting a good mental game going and understanding course management and strategy, right?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I don't know if what I write is really there to help people as much as to help them by making them feel like, hey, you're not alone.
Yeah.
you know, I'm going to help you. This could be therapeutic in terms of helping express, you know, the frustrations that I think a lot of us have.
Yeah, well,
also develop an appreciation of the game by just looking at it from a variety of different angles.
Yeah, and I think that I don't go into this thinking I can help people. It's just that I have a lot of questions.
Exactly.
So let's pick it apart. Let's talk about some of your writing, some of your chapters. I'm assuming that each chapter is based on a different column.
Or
did you just start from scratch?
Some are like, yeah, I stopped writing the columns when I decided the objective was to you know, do a book. So you know, at that stage, I started doing some of the you know, the chapter on golf and psychology, or golf and politics, or golf and religion. You know, again, you know, taking a sort of very different kind of angle on the game than what people normally write.
And let's talk about that. The golf politics. It's a good year to be doing this. Golf politics and psychology. Where do you go with that? Do you start doing interviews? And what is it that chapter would be about? We're just picking chapters at random to talk about now.
Well, in that chapter, no, I didn't do any interviews. I probably should in an expanded version, but I started with, you know, the observation that, you know, most golfers are fairly conservative politically. And, you know, the, yeah, and, well, that's at least what, you know, comes across in the media, or if you, you look at some articles about it. And the conventional explanation for that is, well, look at them. You know, they're hanging out for the most part, you know, at these exclusive golf clubs. They play in the pro-ams, you know, with big, you know, CEOs and rich business types. You know, of course they're going to become conservative. And my response to that in the book is, well, it kind of makes them sound a little canine. Like, you know, oh, here's a little money. Oh, who's a good little golfer? You know, oh, don't you love your corporate sponsor? Yeah, you're a good boy.
And like, are you talking to a dog? You know? Or a golfer?
No, I don't. No. But the, you know, maybe it's a little different. Maybe there's a selection process here, and golf attracts people who are naturally inclined to be conservative. So, you know, if you think about a golfer as opposed to other professional athletes, you know, they aren't part of a team. They're independent businessmen. You know, they're pretty self-sufficient, and it's all on them. So they're going to have an orientation towards life that makes them emphasize personal initiative, personal responsibility. And I think that coincides with more of a, you know, conservative outlook on the world. So I just sort of, you know, that's an example of kind of just exploring something about the game from, you know, again, a slightly different perspective.
I will buy into the fact that professional golfers may be the best entrepreneurs in sports, you know, compared to team sports. But I'll tell you, listening to the way you describe your observations on golfers, clearly you're playing country club golf, because, you know, you come up here and play the public courses in Marin County, just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I got to tell you, I don't come across very many conservative golfers. They're pretty liberal people out here.
Oh, no. I'd have to say membership at my club is fairly liberal as well.
Yeah, versus the Olympic Club.
I'm with
club.
You in terms of, yeah, yeah, but this is an interesting topic and one that I didn't get into in the book, but I have to discuss in my blog. You know, here in the Bay Area, you know, we've had this, you know, interesting and rather annoying challenge to Sharp Park down in Pacifica, which is an Alistair McKenzie designed course that certain faction in San Francisco wants to close down. And they base a lot of their argument on this sort of nasty stereotype of what golfers are all about.
Yeah.
When in actuality, you know, it's not that way at all. That is, that's an unfortunate obstacle or challenge that I feel golf faces. That people, you know, people think about golf like, oh yeah, I know what golf's like. I saw Caddyshack, which is like saying you know what, you know, it's like to be in the medical corps of the Army because you saw MASH. So it's frustrating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So is the entire book just based on observation from you, or did you do research and interviews?
Well, I did. I'm kind of shying away from saying it's all stuff that came out of my head because I'm trying
and
to
I'm
get
forcing
people to
the issue, aren't I?
Right, right. But you know, I did. I looked at some research in terms of you know, there was that Columbia professor who analyzed results of putts in terms of, you know, the fact that pros tend to get cautious on birdie putts, just like the rest of us will kind of get a little cautious on par putts because, you know, you're more worried about
missing
the
it.
Bad outcome than being aggressive and making the good outcome. So, you know, I picked up here, and there was some other stuff in there about, you know, how the mind works. But basically the starting point is, hey, whatever was popping into my head when I was strolling down the fairway.
And do you mind if I just throw out the topics of the chapters and you can riff on that, because it sounds like you were leading into chapter 3, which is fear and greed.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Go.
Well, fear and greed. you know, I used to work on Wall Street. And, you know, there's that old cliche, it's fear and greed that move the market. And, you know, I think that that explains an incredible amount of what happens to us out on the golf course. And I talk in the book about how you can take all your bad shots and you can put them into two buckets. You got the fear bucket and the greed bucket. So the fear bucket, I think we're pretty familiar with, right? You've got, you know, you're short-sighted, you got to get over a bunker, you've got a narrow tee shot, you've got a, you know, difficult downhill putt. You know, any time that your weight stays on your backside, that's a fear shot. You're already backing away from it before you even finished it. You know, and then there are the green shots, right, which we're all familiar with the phenomenon. You know, we're playing well. We were stroking it right down the middle. So the next time we're out there, we're just going to go for a couple more yards off the tee. You know, so you start coming over the top. You know, you're pulling it into the trees. You know, or you were seeing the line well on your putt, so you're going to be able to get a bit more aggressive. You know, and you know now you've got 3 feet coming back. You know, it's just interesting. It's like this metronome, and you go back and forth between those in terms of how you play the game. And I just find it fascinating. I see it happen to myself all the time. I see it in my buddies. It's an interesting dynamic.
Absolutely. I think that we would generally, as you call it, fear and greed, we would call it risk-reward, right?
Right, exactly.
That's
exactly.
Kind of the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, maybe we should team up and I should do a book because we should do a Golf Smarter book because some of the things that you have in these chapters, I'm thinking about all the interviews that I've done, all what, you know, what various experts have said, and just pull, you know, short quotes and comments out of these podcasts and turn that into a book. Because I, going down your list here, I'm curious how you approach what you talk about when you say the pre-shot routine.
Well, the pre-shot routine is, in fact, I just posted on someone's blog this morning, I think Golf Magic, you know, and he's talking about the importance of the pre-shot routine. Now, in the book, you know, as is my want, I do a riff on why that's not so easy. You know, why visualizing the shot doesn't always work out for all of us, because we'll often just go through this, you know, low light reel of all the ways we screwed up that shot in the past. You know, and then, like, you know, committing to the shot can be tough when that's just what you saw, like, you know, spool through your head. And then trusting your swing. I mean, you know, why should I? You know, it hasn't always worked for me. Why should I start trusting it now? So, you know, the routine is there. There's a standard prescription. You know, I try to follow it, but, you know, look, in the book, I'm the first to admit that it doesn't always work for me. And I'm actually trying to work on something now where, I try to clue in on what's kind of nagging at me before a particular shot and do a routine that addresses that and then hit it. And I'll get back to you, Fred. I'll let you know whether that works.
Well, I'm so appreciative that Nick Jurtok, a listener, turned you on to the Golf Smarter podcast, but I think you should be listening to it because...
And I will.
Yeah,
I will.
Thank you. But, what you're going to find, at least what I have found in talking to so many different golf professionals, is that what sounds like when you're doing your pre-shot routine, you're focused on the outcome and not the process. And to me, the pre-shot routine is not, you know, history, as I like to remind people, history has nothing to do with your next shot. You know, what you've done every time you've played this hole, it's like all these mistakes you've made. It's like, then why are you approaching it the same way, right?
Right.
You know, it's like, I just played a round recently where I said, my driver's been getting me in trouble lately, and I'm trying to get myself out of trouble. So, and I know that if I pull out a 3-wood, I'm not just much more comfortable, I'm much more confident of just hitting it straight, and definitely not as far, but I'm closer in so many more ways. So I just hit my 3-wood. Instead of the 14 times I'd hit my driver, I hit my 3-wood like 10 times, and I did pull out the driver a couple times, and I had a great round. So it's like, you know, that definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results.
No, there's no question. And you know, you were spot on in terms of identifying, you know, the problem that I wrestle with, and I think a lot of other people, in terms
Absolutely.
Of getting hung up on outcome instead of process. And, you know, I talk about that in the book. Well, you know, outcomes are how I, you know, pay the mortgage and do everything, right? So
yeah.
It's kind of hard to shift gears from being, you know, thought-oriented, analytic, et cetera, and then turn that switch off and do something else. That's one of the really fascinating and somewhat addictive challenges of the game.
Well, and I think that comes back to the title of Why We Golf. I think it's trying to get away from that hustle, bustle, grind, and the daily crap that we go through, which we call life, you know, and just be able for 4 hours to say, nothing matters right now except for the next shot.
Right, exactly.
Only the next shot, which is, I like to say, the hardest shot in golf is the next shot.
Well, you know, and I talk about this in the book, that, there's this advice, Bob Rotella and others will have, you're supposed to fall in love, with the next shot. But my problem is breaking up with the last one.
Good point. Yeah, it's a love-hate relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's the how come I'm blanking on the term when you a rebound relationship.
That's right.
It's like I hated her, but I'm coming back anyway with that club. Okay, I'm going to toss out another one. Let's go to rules and handicaps, chapter 8. What do you have to say about that? I have lots of thoughts about the rules of golf and handicaps and things like that. How do you approach it?
Well, with rules, I'm not a real rule hound, right? So I'm not one of these guys that can memorize and quote it. I don't carry around the little booklet with me. I think sometimes I love reading the dispatches or press releases that the USGA will put out on rulings. And some of its stuff almost seems like Talmudic in their, the degree in which they sort of parse, the implications of this and that. And I have some fun with that in terms of talking about the book. In terms of handicaps, if you look at and you listen to people talk about them, and I discuss this in the book, handicaps, came out around the same time in the U.S. as the income tax did.
Oh, is that
and
right?
People will talk about them in kind of the same way, so that the people that have to give strokes feel like it's this kind of corrupt system of redistribution, and the people who get strokes think it's only beginning to approximate what kind of makes things a level playing ground. So you have this back and forth that goes on. And, then I talk about handicaps in terms of what about, using them in different ways? Instead of just getting, say your six shots on the six toughest holes, being able to tell, your opponent, okay, 5 for 4, why not, have something where you could say at any point in the round, all right, I'm using one of my six shots, you're going to have to hit that one over. And, so I have fun with the idea that would completely tweak your opponent. There's no way he could strike the 5-iron 2 times in a row. And that would be just a kind of a, somewhat sadistic, but just for the sake of argument, different way of using the handicap when you play.
I frequently think about rules in golf and the USGA and how, in my mind, the USGA is an advocate for the golf course, not the golfer.
Good point.
I think that their rules are, when they talk about the preservation and the respect of the game, they don't have the golfer in mind. And I think there's a direct correlation on why there are fewer and fewer golfers every year. And the industry is, bleeding to death because the business is not good. But the USGA is, got their feet planted in the sand going, no, this is how it's going to be.
No, it feels to me like the game is almost like some sort of stuffy French restaurant, with a pre-fixé menu, and this is what you get, and these are the portions that you get, mm-hmm. and these are the rules that govern how you eat and how we made things, and I think that it's choking off the game, and it's making it hard in a time when people are so time pressured. And there's so many conflicting demands on people's time to get them, to take up something that's, in its standard format, is 4+ hours of, you know, a fairly challenging game.
Do you have any suggestions on what they could do to make golf fit today's lifestyle better?
I mentioned this in the book. You know, I'm fortunate enough to be a member of a private club. And, you know, people who aren't would think, oh, man, if you belong to a golf club, that means you can play as much golf as you want. Actually, the real benefit is you can play as little as you want on certain times. So like yesterday afternoon, I took a break from work. I went out. I played 6 holes. And then, you know, I went back to work. It was great. You know, I mean, you're right on the other side of the bridge. You know how nice the weather's been around here recently. And
driest winter in history.
Yes. That's a little scary, actually.
It is scary, but it's great for golf.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good for us.
Yeah.
To get back to that thought of playing as little as you like, I think the big, big thing that, you know, challenges that the sport confronts is time. And, you know, if you go online and there are these discussions about time in golf, people talk about, well, pace of play is an issue. But I really think that's kind of splitting hairs. I mean, that's sort of, all right, that's the difference between 4 hours and 20 minutes and 4 hours, right? And that's not going to move the dial for a lot of people. Like you were saying, it's the ability to go out, you know, stroll out there, be outside, play for an hour, hour and a half, and then get on with your life. The game should be able to offer that to people.
Well, the book is called Why We Golf, and tell us how we can find it, how we can get a copy for ourselves.
Go on Amazon and just, you know, search for Why We Golf. It's available in Kindle format and in paperback.
Great.
And, I hope people check it out. People who've been reading it have been telling me how much they enjoyed it. You know, I've got a golf rap song in there. I've got a science fiction chapter, a modern romance chapter. I can guarantee you, you have not read a golf book like this ever. This is a completely different take on the game. And the main point is, hey, let's have some fun with this. Let's laugh at ourselves. Let's laugh at the game. But let's keep on playing.
Yeah, it's a fun read. It's definitely a fun read. And this has been really interesting. Thank you so much for coming on. If you want to learn more, your website, whywegolf.wordpress.com, correct?
That's correct.
And I thank you so much for the conversation, and best of luck with the book.
Hey, Fred, I really enjoyed it.
Well, that interview went a little shorter than normal, so if you don't mind, I'd like to take a couple extra minutes. Thank you for sending in your questions to Martin Chuck. One of the questions I thought was valid to share with everybody, so I thought I'd put Martin back on the phone to answer the question so you can all get that. Martin, thank you so much for coming back on to Golf Smarter for Members Only.
Fred, it's my pleasure to be back in the air with you.
I appreciate it. Make sure your hands free right now if you're driving.
Absolutely.
Although it would be kind of funny if you got pulled over while we were talking. But anyway, pulled over is the absolute worst thing that we would want to happen. So I got a question in from Sebastian Sutton over in McKinney, Texas. And he wanted to know about increasing his distance with the Tour Striker. He says, I already hit the ball a fair distance, but not always straight. It's his 9-iron about 145, which is pretty good. 145 for 9-iron is good. 5-iron, 190. 4-iron, he hits a 4-iron. He's not hitting a hybrid. He hits that 210. But these are the maximum distances, which is kind of interesting.
Right.
So if I hit it perfectly, you know, how often does that happen, right? Is that really the number you put in your head? So he just wants to know, will the Tour Striker give me more distance or better solid contact with the forward lean?
Well, I mean, the answer, it depends on the player, but in most cases, yes. Now, in Sebastian's case, you know, he already has great length. I mean, that's 9-iron, 145, 4-iron, 210, that is long. And in his case, maybe he's got more untapped compression available. What I mean by that is when you deliver the shaft with a few degrees of forward lean, you know, you're also de-lofting the face a little bit, so it takes away the obliqueness of the strike and provides, you know, more compression, which will give you greater distance. So in his case, if he doesn't have the forward lean and downward strike of, say, the top strikers, then of course it's going to give more distance. Now for the average golfer out there, that's where it's really making its biggest impression, because they realize, hey, wait a second, I don't return this club to vertical. I actually let this club lag and relax, and as a result of that, the shaft is leaning a little bit, I'm de-lofting the face a little bit, and therefore I get more distance.
Again, I want to advise everybody and ask everybody to go ahead and send Martin in some questions. And the questions that have already come in, Martin has already responded via email. He's written back to people, and he's also, and I think we can share this, if you use the coupon code GOLFSMARTER when you go to touristtracker.com and place your order, you will be getting a discount of how much?
It's 10% and free shipping.
Wow. Oh, well, there you go. You get the free shipping and 10% discount. So if you're in the States, you're going to be saving money, no question, even if you go to buy it at a local retailer. But let's talk about those folks who are out of the States, because we do have listeners, especially this time of year. We get a lot of email from Australia because they're in the middle of their summer. Do you ship to Australia?
Of course. We have we ship to Australia, and we're actually working on a distributor down there, so they don't have to worry about the freight piece anymore, and we're pretty close to getting that settled, but it's a few months away. But we do ship all over the world, and shipping from the U.S. to most places in the world, it costs $30.
And what about Canada?
In Canada, we have a distributor that it's available up there in all the golf towns, which is the big box store across Canada. If you need a special order club that we built down here, again, international shipping would be $30. But in most cases, if you get online to your golf town or, you know, you give them a call, they'll order one for you, and you can avoid the international shipping, which can get expensive, and occasionally they can get held up in customs too, which we don't like.
No, we don't like that. But if you do go to your big box retailer or any retailer, you're not going to be able to get the Golf Smarter discount. Is that correct?
Right. No. You can say it all you want, and the guy might look at you like, I've heard of that, but it won't help you there.
Yeah, right. Hopefully they've heard of that. And Europe, same thing. Writing from UK and Europe.
Right, exactly. You know, in the UK, we have a distributor there, and it is available in a lot of the larger retailers in certainly the UK. So, I mean, it would behoove you just to get online and Google it in the UK. I'm sure it'll pop up in a few of the retail shops, because we do have a distributor that probably sells a couple thousand Touristrackers a year. So I'm glad I'm making a dent in good old Liverpool with their ball striking over there.
All right, well, once again, I encourage everybody, if you have any questions about your ball striking, your game, mental part of it, your intention, please go to golfsmarter.com and click on the Hey Fred button and submit your question to Martin, and he will get back to you. Martin, thanks so much for coming on once again and bailing us out here.
And drive, oh, my pleasure, my friend.
And drive carefully.
You got it, pal. Take care.
A couple of weeks ago, I bumped into an old friend. Actually, I was his soccer coach when he was 13. Now he's a dentist. Anyway, we were talking at the driving range, and I told him about Golf Smarter. I bumped into again this past weekend, and he told me that he's not only listening to the podcast, but he's talking to the folks at Score Golf after hearing episode number 307 with Terry Kaler. Now he's planning on improving his short game by taking advantage of the Golf Smarter discount on a set of custom 4161 wedges. Of course, I was flattered that he's now listening, but frankly, I was a bit shocked that he's making this purchase, because this kid, dentist, doctor, is complaining that he's up to a 5 handicap. Obviously, it doesn't matter how good or how bad you feel about your game. It can always improve. Golf Digest has put the Score Golf 4161 wedges on their hot list for 2012. Here's your chance to put them on your must-do list. Whether you order online or over the phone, use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER15 and get your 15% members-only discount. For everything you need to know, click on the Score Golf banner on the members page at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.